Hello and welcome to today's program in the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Saving America's Kids, One Playground at a Time, with Daryl Hammond of Kaboom. I think it's going to be a great program here. I would invite you, our audience listening at home, to please check out our website at www.commonwealthclub.org. And it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight. I'm just going to read you a brief introduction. I think a lot of you know him already, but Daryl Hammond is the founder and CEO of Kaboom, a not-for-profit based in Washington, D.C., dedicated to saving play by making sure there is a great place to play within walking distance of every child in America. Kaboom works with communities and corporations to build playgrounds where there are none in all 50 states. To help start the conversation and educate Americans about the importance of play in children's lives, Daryl wrote Kaboom, How One Man Built a Movement to Save Play. Founded out of Hammond's apartment in 1996, Kaboom has raised $200 million, rallied a million volunteers, led the hands-on construction of 2,000 playgrounds, and inspired a movement for the child's right to play. Daryl lives in Washington, D.C. with his wife, Kate Becker. And now, here's Daryl Hammond.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. He certainly is right that I feel like this is a hometown crowd, because as I watched everybody walk in and look out at the crowd, there's certainly a lot of people that have known me and been around both the work of the organization directly by supporting me and the projects that we've worked on, but indirectly supporting the movement for the child's right to play. And as Kevin talked about, this is our 15th anniversary as the organization. And 2 years ago, when we sat around and said, what do we want that anniversary to look like? What do we want that birthday to look like? We really thought about, why don't we write a book and use the platform of the book to try to enroll more people into the cause about what we care about. And what we really care about and what's written in the book is this community stories and individual stories to collective action, to save play. And, you know, it begins with my personal story of when I was 2 years old. My father left my mother after the birth of my younger sister. And he was a cross-country truck driver. He went to unload a truck and never came back. And my mom, for 2 years, tried to raise us until we were 4 years old. Had a nervous breakdown. And she was faced with the situation either of putting us in individual foster facilities or being moved halfway across the country from Jerome, Idaho, to Chicago, Illinois, where we could all be in the same facility called Moose Heart, the Child City. And she made the choice to actually bring us there so that we could be together, and then actually joined us while we were there. And I think back on both the situation, and in writing this book, I also only come to realize that my father was one of 14 people, and his parents gave up his kids and him. And he grew up in foster care himself. And I thought about this cycle, and you're going to hear me talk about in this book about breaking cycles sometimes of dysfunction, and how do we get out of the path or trajectory that we may be on, and this personal transformation that happens. So for 14 years, I was blessed to live on a 1,200-acre campus. We had one of the best schools, finest sports programs, and as all the other schools around us were facing difficult financial times, the men and women of the Moose Lodges across the country would send $35 a year or 10 cents a day in what they considered ABCD funds, a big charity dollar, to the kids at Moose Heart. And at every night, they would literally pause in these 1,200 lodges across the country and say a prayer to the kids that were under their care. And I was one of those kids. So I feel this tremendous sense of both gratitude, but also this sense of purpose about other people supported me in the times of toughest needs. And part of why I do what I do now is certainly because of that experience. And so I dropped out, went to community college, went to a four-year college, dropped out, flunked out, kicked out. It all depends on who you ask, what day you ask. Although 2 years ago, they did want to make me an alumni so they can start soliciting me and gave me an honorary degree and a solicitation at the same time. But when I was in college, a roommate of mine, mom, was organizing a project 3 hours from school. And we went down to a Bob Leathers playground in Evanston, Illinois, called Penny Park, that the kids had helped design and that the community had actually built. And we were cheap labor for pizza and beer. And for two weekends in a row, we descended down on Evanston, Illinois, and participated in this community's kind of building the civic space and a shared sense of history together. But that experience really didn't mean anything to me at that time, to be quite honest. It happened later on when I had left, could not go back, afford to go back to school, so I joined National Service, and I was working in Chicago. And in Chicago, they asked me to go to Columbus, Ohio, to organize a service project. And what had traditionally happened in these service projects was that because of public transportation, people would descend on a site bright and early in the morning, and either hundreds or thousands of people would show this unified front about what can be accomplished. And then they would fan out on public transportation and do projects like paint shelters and put gardens in at schools, and then they'd come back at the end of the day and celebrate. Well, in Columbus, that couldn't happen because there was no public transportation. So I thought back to the experience of building the playground and said, wow, in fewer sites we can have more people involved. But the company, Bob Leathers, had never done it before, working with an intermediary organization such as ours. Coupled with the fact he didn't do it in low-income communities, he was really doing it in middle to upper-income communities that had already had this organizing mentality, that had structures like PTAs and PTOs, and this was just another project that they were getting ready to pull off. Whereas in Columbus at Indianola Middle School, they didn't have a PTA and a PTO. There was nobody in charge of school fundraising. So they needed this kind of third party to act as a coach to help meet them where they were at and then provide them some coaching and confidence to have this transformation kind of happen at the end. And I write in the book that as good as two playgrounds got built, it was a lousy experience. And I learned a lot of lessons about what would work and why it worked. And then I learned a lot of lessons about myself, too, as an individual. So lo and behold, I get asked to go to Washington, D.C., and to organize another service project. And it happened to be we were going to do a playground again. And we picked this Livingston Manor community, housing development. And while I was working on that project, two kids, Aisha and Clarendon, 2 and 4 years old, crawled into an abandoned car in Washington, D.C., and suffocated and died. And the Washington Post reporter went out and did a story. Over several weeks, she surveyed the space around the housing authority. And she kept walking in concentric circles, and it took 3 miles for her to actually find a green space, a park, a playground. There was no swimming pools, no courts, no basketball facilities, and this 2 and 4 year old kids were left to crawl into an abandoned car. And the front page of the Washington Post had this gripping headline about no place to play. And then it went on to talk about all that was wrong with this community and how nobody was going to step forward, and that the memory of these kids was essentially, once this article was written, potentially going to be gone. So from my personal experience of having people in my life for 14 years and building playgrounds, it gave me the sense of purpose and passion that I could be the one to do something about this. And that was really the birth of the organization Kaboom. The name comes from, and it's always come from, this sense of hope and opportunity that can be unleashed. Just look at the logo and look at the colors. And when small ideas start to germinate, and you know, we talk about the three pillars of change for us is about common cause, getting people to fight for something instead of fighting against something, achievable wins, breaking up the project so that along the way, mentality, you're giving people little wins that create confidence. And that confidence creates a desire, a will, an appreciation to want to do more stuff. And then after that, that third and final step is cascading steps of courage and leadership. And I say all of this with my friend and founding board member, Tony Dyfel, in the room because it was really him who put words to those statements there. And I think you actually did research and found out that when people did courageous things in a moment of crisis, where they stepped in front of a train or a car, it really was out of an act of having done small things that when they were thrust into an unknown situation, they could put themselves in that spot. And what we wanted to do was to use playgrounds and the process of a definable project on a definable timeline to do exactly that, to give the community an opportunity to fight for something, to have achievable wins, and then after that, beyond maintaining the space, try to go on and actually create a healthy and vibrant community of neighbors and fun. After our first playground project, it really took off, to be quite honest. We met the founders of Home Depot, and it's true, and I write about in the book, that my naivete thought that the money would come from government or foundations, because that's who funds stuff. And I had the opportunity to meet many of those foundations through our partnership with Marion Wright Edelman at the Children's Defense Fund, but I couldn't convince people that they should give away their money to me to do this process of building playgrounds, both because play was important, and by doing the process, people would find their civic voice. So you're really solving two problems at once. You know, you're using the civic engagement tool to build playgrounds, and by building playgrounds, you're creating civic engagement tools. So what have we learned in some of those stories? I write and talk about in the book some of my favorites in terms of Ray Hood, who was 72 years old when I first met her. And in her community, separated by our railroad tracks, her kids played on the other side of the railroad tracks, but it was a community that didn't want their kids there. And they decided to erect a 12-foot wall. And she tried to fight it, and she lost. And once she lost, she said, "We got to build these kids a playground." And at 72 years old, her and her church elders, all the planning committee was probably above 60 years old, organized one of the most memorable projects still to me to this day, and built another playground. And she said to me one time, the degree of success was now the kids on that side wanted to come to our playground and play on our side. And she said, we let them. Now, what's even more amazing about Ray Hood to me was that before she passed, she did 6 more playgrounds without us. She literally became known as kind of the playground lady of San Antonio, Texas. Very recently, I happened to be in Los Angeles, and I ran into David Robinson, the basketball player from the San Antonio Spurs. And his association with Kaboom is not directly coming out on Kaboom projects, but is Ray Hood and the impact and ripple that she always said she was building a Kaboom playground, but Kaboom was never there. So he always thought he was supporting Kaboom, when in reality he was supporting a local, literally, at 72, 73, 74-year-old community activist. And I think that that's one of the true measures of success, at least in Kaboom's story, that some of the greatest accomplishments that we've had are ripples that we may never hear about. And I write a lot in the book both about that public-private partnership model, but also I make this case that as social change agents, we have to figure out a way to be in it for the cause, not the credit. And yes, you know, credit is important in terms of being able to build a brand and being able to fundraise, but at the end of the day, people want to get involved in something both that they can do and that other people are doing it for a different reason instead of just getting this emotional feeling out of it as a one-time experience. The second story I write about in the book is Juanita Hatton in Nicetown, Philadelphia. And she had Colin Powell and Vice President Gore show up on her playground project, and it was an amazing day. And all of a sudden, after all this work had gone on to it, and she lived right across the street, she woke up as she did every morning, went across the street, saw the playground had graffiti on it, and she was devastated. And she didn't know what to do. She walked back, and while thinking about it, walking back, as an hourly employee, she called in sick and went back to the playground and scrubbed their graffiti off. Because as she told me, she did not want the kids to come home from school that day with graffiti on the playground that their family and that people they didn't even know come out and see it. Unfortunately, this happened several times over a couple of months' time. And every day when she got up, she went to check on that playground. And if there was graffiti on it, she called in sick, losing her hourly wages for that day to scrub the playground so that the kids would not see it with graffiti on it. Interestingly enough, Juanita Hatton was not the co-chair of that project. She was the volunteer recruitment chair. And she had recruited all the other volunteers. So she had a stake in it, but she wasn't the leader of it. And she got the word out in the community that she would do this as long as somebody would graffiti it. And before you know it, it stopped. And we were on a call with her just a couple of months ago, and she reported that 14 years later, the playground still looks as if it was new and had never been graffitied again. She also likes to tell me that they have a birthday party on the date that the playground was built every year. And people come out, and it's a celebration. And part of doing that is to keep the spirit in the folklore alive about how this park was created for both new people who are coming and living there and other people who have moved away for them to have a reason to come back. And she loves to tell me about, you know, every year she asks the question of how many people were here when this was built. And she says a lot of hands go up. And she knows that they weren't, but because of doing those birthday parties and the story that continues to get told, people convince themselves that they wanted to be there, almost as like a Woodstock experience. And I think in all the work that all of us are doing, that's a really important component. My project manager sitting in the back of the room there, we were recently in Dallas, Texas, and he was driving down the highway, and he said, I built that playground. He pulls over, and one of the coaches who had been involved in the project happened to be there that day, as he told me. And he said the pride that radiated from this coach about this community that couldn't get any volunteers to do anything that now has problems with the number of volunteers and that their management skills have to increase because all these people want to now be involved in different pieces and components of the community organizing. That's the cascading steps of courage and leadership that goes way beyond a playground. Or I talk about Cynthia Gentry because my friend Thomas is sitting here. And, you know, when the internet got started and my wife and I got married, we typed in to the search engine and found The Knot. And on The Knot, we needed an announcement card. But I saw this whole project management tool that somebody who was getting married could actually organize a wedding for all the guests and make it real easy. And I said, why can't you do that for playgrounds? Because all community-built playgrounds are is a project management module. And so we quickly went about trying to build a tool to enable people to self-organize so that if Kaboom couldn't come to you, and at that time we were getting, you know, we were doing 100 playgrounds a year, maybe we were getting 2,000 requests for the 100 playgrounds. Today, by the way, we get 183 playgrounds we directly build, 14,000 requests a year. And I'm going to go on to talk about the deficit that exists and how we can solve that in a minute. But we adapted this tool of the internet to enable Cynthia Gentry and her community and the tragic story that her neighbor, who lived literally right next door to her, that in a micro storm, a tree fell on a car, killing the wife and two kids. And she wanted to spring to action. And the neighbors didn't know what to do. And the father said, can we build a park in their memory? She didn't know how to build a park before. She went online. She found us. The type of community that they were organizing in was a higher income than threshold than what we could work with. But coupled with the fact they had the capacity to actually do it themselves, all they needed was the know-how and the process and the incremental steps. And online, it was all there in an open source way so that not only could Cynthia learn what other people have done, Cynthia could then come back and contribute her own wisdom and know-how to help other people who may be in her situation and circumstances. And not every circumstance ends up into Aisha and Clarendon's situation where they died or in Cynthia's circumstance and situation. But we all know tough communities where kids are essentially being left behind. And I hope to inspire all of us to continue to do more about those circumstances until it's too late. And Cynthia went on, raised $300,000. $300,000 in about 3 months' worth of time. And about 100 days after this tragedy, in Virginia Highlands in Atlanta, they built the Kennard Playground Park. And it's absolutely awesome. And it's still awesome to this day. And Cynthia Gentry has gone on from that experience doing so many other amazing things, including when the city cut money and was going to close 20 park and rec centers. She sprung to action, called the Parks Council people, who were at the time not very organized, got them organized, got a petition signed, got an op-ed in the newspaper, got a meeting with the mayor, Sheila Franklin at the time, and made the case. This is a citizen. Made the case, and all those centers are still open today because of her efforts. She went on to design a treehouse. She held an international design competition for the playground of the future. This is an individual citizen who has no organization that does this kind of on her side time, but has become so passionate about contributing and learning that our mission has been extended and expanded. And it doesn't just become about Kaboom, the organization. It really does become about the movement to save play. And to talk about that just for a minute, it's startling to me to understand that only 1 in 5 kids live within a quarter of a mile to a park or a playground. Only 1 in 5 kids. And in low-income minority communities, it's drastically less. And if they do have one, it's probably pretty good evidence that the quality is not as good as it could or really should be for the kids. The second thing is, think about it. Kids now get 7.5 hours of screen time a day, video, TV, or monitor of some way, shape, or fashion. 7.5 hours. Now, there are societal trends that go along with that because roaming, a decade ago, kids used to roam upwards to a mile from their parents. Now, anybody take a guess what it is? 2 blocks? 1 block? 30 feet. 30 feet. So if we don't let them out of our sight, right, they get tethered. And there is some evidence that suggests that this generation of parents is the first generation of parents that were babysat in front of a television. And as the workplace started to change and both parents started to go into the workplace, they were sat in front of the television. So their acceptance of screens is very different than any other generation. Stuart Brown, who wrote the foreword to this book, actually makes the case that childhood has changed in the last decade more than it has in the last century. That it's changed more in the last 10 years than it has in a whole century. And the question is, do we have the kind of desire and will to do something about it? He also says that play is the best natural resource in a creative economy. And, I frequently get asked, okay, Daryl, what's the best type of play? Well, the best type of play is all types of play. And what's happening, though, is that you have kids who aren't making the choices about where and how they play. Their parents are doing it for them. Tom Ferry, who wrote the book Play On, did a study. And he shows that peewee attendance of sports is up. Little League attendance is down. And what he suggests is that parents choose to put kids into Pee Wee, and when kids start to choose Little League, they don't want to participate anymore. And there's also lots of evidence that we're single-tracking kids. We're getting kids into one activity that's adult-directed, adult-facilitated, either it be sports and team-based, or even music and band. And I'm not saying those things are bad, but much like a balanced diet of food, a balanced diet of play is absolutely fundamentally necessary. And what we want to see is what Mike's doing down in Palo Alto with Playborhood, which is about building creative spaces right out your front yard and in every community across the country that enables the kids to direct their own activity. Take a box, and what can you turn it into? I've recently been reading about the map that you painted of your neighborhood and how the kids are building it instead of parking in the driveway. And that's the type of play that we're talking about, because that type of play, in terms of solving the play deficit, is building intrinsic motivation versus extrinsic rewards. And, you know, I constantly am hearing that people think play is a luxury, not a necessity. And I want to make the case that it's through play that kids build the social skills, the muscular development of their body, and the creativity, both for a fun childhood, but also to build the skills necessary to adapt to an ever-changing world that they're going to inherit. A magazine recently reported that CEOs, Fortune 100 CEOs, said the two skills that they need most in employees is adaptability and creativity. Where do you think that that comes from? It comes right from the earliest days of choice and turning a box into a fort, and then turning that same fort of a box into a castle or a spaceship. And kids need to figure out, you know, how everything around them can essentially be a toy without it necessarily having to be a toy. And we need to go back to the experience that some of us remember, that when you opened up on Christmas morning any presents, that sometimes you played with the box longer than you did the actual toy. And I would challenge us to say, you know, how can we turn a stick into being more than a stick? Even if it's a sword, it's okay. And, you know, the book really ends on this call to action about some ideas about how we can go from individual and organizational to movement. And what I'm asking everybody to do is, in the last chapter, 14 different things, and I want to cover three of them here tonight. The first thing I think we need to do is to create a map of the state of play and figure out where the deficit exists in both quality and quantity. So in a couple of weeks, we're launching mobile technology that you can download to any gadget that you have, Apple or Android. And when you're at a park, when you're at a baseball field, when you're at a basketball court, upload it and tell us what the quality of it is. Because we had this experience in Tucson, Arizona, where a community organizer, unpaid, said that the state of play was weak and nobody believed her. So she went out and mapped it. And she asked people to say, what's the quality of this? So it wasn't just her opinion, it was a whole bunch of people's opinion. And then she presented it to the city council. And when she presented it to the city council, she showed where the play spaces were. And when I say play spaces, I'm talking about more than just playgrounds. Parks and fields. So it's a lot of that. And she showed it to the city council. And then she took a chart and she rolled down and she said, now, here's the income levels associated with this. Now she pulled down another layer and she said, here's the race. And then she pulled down a third one and she said, now here's where our unhealthy kids already are living. And it was no coincidence that in the low-income minority areas, they had less access, and if they did have access, the quality of their environment was not as good as in other places in the city. So learning from that experience, what we want to see people to do is to adopt this map of figuring out where the play opportunities are and what the quality of them are. Because that funnels the next two things in terms of building and improving what's there. You know, and we don't just need to build more play opportunities, but better play opportunities for kids too. And, you know, as an organization, we've taken that on by partnering with David Rockwell and starting Imagination Playground, where we're taking these loose form blocks and actually saying they could be a playground themselves, or they can complement an existing playground, where kids will play longer, play harder, and actually create a desire for them to want to come back and play more often. That's our fundamental premise. It's still very much in pilot form, but already we're seeing great success with it. And it could be empty boxes, too. It doesn't necessarily have to be the Imagination Playground blocks. But we need to look at where they are, what the quality, and how can we improve upon it is. I love in Richmond, Colorado. I mean Richmond, California. Here, one woman kept hearing from all the neighbors that crime was a problem. This is gone, and she literally talks about when her kids were young, that was the problem, and when her kids got out of high school, went on to college, that was the problem. And she said her kids came back, did not have a job, so she paid a minimum wage, gave them a park ranger shirt, and sent them down to the park. And told him to spend 8 hours a day there and just watch. And literally, she wanted to record how many people were using the park and not using the park. And as soon as word got out in the neighborhood that there was adults there and they were kind of cool, kids started to show up. And now 3 years into this program, she still hires college and high school kids to supervise the parks during the summers, after school, and on weekends, and kids show up. And the crime doesn't happen there anymore. So there are solutions to some of these things that are big and small. What it takes is somebody to step forward and raise their hand, much like Ray Hood did, Cynthia Gentry did, and be the one to want to make the change. The third thing we're asking everybody to do in terms of that leadership is to show up. And 2 weeks before Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, almost 6 years ago now, I got a call from the superintendent of schools. And she was telling me about that they had two issues on the agenda, recess and the school lunch menu. And they had to separate it because the school lunch menu, 600 parents signed up to provide testimony. When recess came up, 3 parents were in the room. And she said, "Daryl, we cut recess without any consequences." And the reality is since 2000, 52% of elementary schools across the country have cut recess. And I would argue they've probably cut it without consequences. So the third thing that we really need people to do is to both understand, advocate, and show up so that there are consequences to the actions that somebody else may be taking on our behalf simply because we're not there. Imagine if 600 people were there for recess. We could make a difference. And so I hope the book inspires you from these stories and more. We also go in to talk a little bit about some of the nuts and bolts of running a social enterprise, the public-private partnerships that we've been able to build, the innovation that we've had, and the decision points around those innovations, scale, depth, franchise. So I think there's a lot in the book for everybody. I hope that you buy a copy and read it. I hope that you pass it on. But more importantly, I hope that I've convinced you that one, play matters, and two, your voice matters. And if it's for play or something else, stand up and be the one to be counted so that there are consequences for what you believe in. I appreciate it, and I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Daryl Hammond. And I would like to remind our audience listening at home that we're the Commonwealth Club of California. This is a business and leadership program tonight. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum. Our program tonight, Saving Kids One Playground at a Time, with Daryl Hammond, CEO and co-founder of Kaboom, and the author of Kaboom, the book. So if there are questions, please ask them at the microphone so that they will be recorded for our audience listening at home. And I have one question. What happened with the Ben and Jerry's ice cream? I read your book, and I love the part about the Pop Rocks ice cream.
Yeah. So it's a great story around public-private partnerships and, frankly, patient capital, in as much as everybody asks us how we've been so successful at building relationships with some of the biggest and best corporations in the country. And what I tell them is you start small and you build big. And everybody's befuddled by that. They want to start big and end big. And the Ben & Jerry's a great example of when I moved to Washington, D.C., a friend of mine was managing a local Ben & Jerry's. She would invite me down. I would eat free ice cream. I got to know the manager of the store, and the manager of the store liked what we were doing. And she said, "I will donate ice cream to you for your projects free, and your projects that you're organizing could raise money as a fundraiser." So for literally every build we did in Washington, D.C., and across the country where there is a franchisee, they would get them involved in giving ice cream to our community partners. They would have ice cream socials, raise money, and it helped get projects started across the country. So after that experience, though, Free Cone Day came up. And every year, Ben and Jerry's, on their birthday, gives away free ice cream. And she started this tradition of, I'm going to ask people to make a donation to Kaboom. In 1 year, we literally raised $8,000 by people making a voluntary contribution. And we would come out and staff it and have a lot of fun and educate people on the importance of play. As we were expanding across the country, and so was Ben and Jerry's, the next thing we did was we literally created a flyer about 25 actions that you could take to save play in your neighborhood. It wasn't a brand building, and it wasn't a fundraiser. It was content that a local franchisee could use to motivate people in their community about doing something that made it relevant to them, even if they'd never heard of Kaboom. And that gave us access to 169 franchisees. And when they heard, the success of the pamphlet, was the next thing was they wanted to build a playground. So at their annual franchisee meeting for several years in a row, and Melanie Barnes had the fortunate opportunity to lead many of them, we built playgrounds with Ben and Jerry's franchisee. And then we went into this conversation about, can't you do millions of dollars for playgrounds? No, we can't. But what we can do is, let's name an ice cream flavor after Kaboom. Best asset they had, right? So they literally, after 18 months of development, came out with Kaberry Kaboom, which is a blueberry, strawberry, chocolate fudge-covered ice cream with Pop Rocks in it. Pop Rocks because it explodes in your mouth, and it is memorable. And that enabled us to both get huge recognition across the country as a growing organization, because it had Pop Rocks on it, and Katie Kirk at the time on the Today Show loved it and talked about it all the time. And the retail partners loved it, and it funded four playgrounds, $250,000. Ben and Jerry's could not write a check for $250,000. They used their best asset, a flavor, and turned it loose. That took 5 years to develop. Talk about patient capital. And I think that if you look at a lot of our relationships, the best things come, and they arc, and they ebb and flow. And when we've faced challenging things, it's been our partners who've bailed us out. And sometimes when our partners have faced challenging things, it's been us that have come in to tell other people in the community that they're not as bad as maybe this one circumstance or situation may lead them to think. And that's why our partnerships have been successful. And I would still like our, we wrote the book because we couldn't get the ice cream flavor back. We did make a valiant attempt to try to get the flavor back. And it's in the graveyard in Vermont. I visit it every time I'm there. So we wrote the book in lieu of getting the flavor back. But if Ben and Jerry are listening, we're still open to it. Mike.
Yeah, Daryl, you talked about your quest to cause real cultural change in communities so the kids will, for a long time after you're gone, still play and be outside and have a real cultural childhood. There's another philosophy of playground building or play-space building. Some people, for instance, in England, build adventure playgrounds, and there, these playgrounds are sort of built by kids over a long period of time, and the kids get a real investment in their play space. Could you talk about maybe some of the internal debates you might have at Kaboom about quick build, get some corporate volunteers in here versus letting the community own it and letting it evolve over a period of time?
That's great. So fair point. And my wife and I were able to visit the UK last year and visit most of the adventure playgrounds that are actually still open. And I think that there's a romanticized version of what the ones that are depth and do right, and there are not very many of them left. What we were seeing as adventure playgrounds are not in sum total the real adventure playgrounds that everybody romanticizes. But showing up at a playground and seeing a fire pit, as an example, and kids feeding the fire was a truly phenomenal experience about, what is the best type of play for kids. And it's all types of play, including this risk and danger. Fascinating. At Kaboom, I think the conversation is, and we've got a great example right here, that, Kaboom is about having immediate impact. And, there is a lot of support that suggests slow design. And one of the projects that we visited with an architect over there, he made this great case about, here's the blueprint that I designed for an accessible school, And if I would have built it all up front, it would have never have worked. Because the way that people actually used the space after putting a couple of components there changed my thinking and flow about the space. And there's certainly a lot to be said with that. What I like about it is I was asking this gentleman who was involved in a Kaboom playground project, and they didn't get their garden all the way done. So 2 years later, they're still working on their garden. So in some aspects, the slow design still comes from the Big Bang. And, you know, in not all instances maybe, but in majority of the instances, we do see adoption of different type of activities and things like that. Our project management team, and we've got Ann sitting back there as well, we constantly think about, you know, what can you leave that behind that wants them wanting more? You know, so that, you set the table, you get something done that creates the achievable win, and then you watch all the other things that take place afterwards. So, ongoing debate, we have some evidence that there is great ripples like the garden project here and other projects, but we can have more input and thought into it as well. Now, I think we're very interested in what is nature play, how do you build nature play. We did one in Hawaii, which was a great experience for us. It's not very replicable from a process standpoint, but if you look online, where the beauty of our online tools is, we can share that knowledge that says, here's what we learned, here's what we wouldn't do again, and you know, I also talk about in the book, be a better us and not a worse them. And I say this because when I was in Hawaii building a nature playground, a green play space designer came up and just bashed us every single day. You shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. And it was frustrating, to be quite honest. And it was humbling because I knew he had something to contribute as well. We left town only to find out that the signature project that he built had been closed for 2 months because of, you know, some issues. And so he was trying to redirect the attention from him to saying what we were doing was not going to be right. And what we did, I feel a lot of pride in, and the YMCA tells us it's the best project that they could have ever wanted in their space.
First, I just want to say thank you for seeing your vision through.
Tell us who you are.
My name is Tim Yonigan with the One World Football Project. Recognizing the work of people like Dr. Stuart Brown and the growing and maturing movement of sport for peace and development worldwide through the United Nations and other auspices, and the things that you pointed out, saying like, play is still perceived as a luxury. Aside from the obvious things that you have cited and learned along the way, can you talk about the practical theories that have evolved from the difference between the work that's been done and the work that you have observed, and how to go from here to there to where we recognize the absolute biological necessity for play?
Yeah, I think the research is out there. It's not very well marketed and communicated would be number one, and I think we're interested in trying to codify that. I think the second thing is that I am a big believer in, Kevin Carroll from Rules of the Red Rubber Ball, you know, really talks about play begins in the making. And if you look at his ball collection that he's been able to amass, it's in many parts of the country and world that the play doesn't begin until the kids figure out how to put a ball together, and that's where a lot of the fun actually begins. So I think that there's this makers movement that is certainly a piece of how people to get them to bear witness and experience it, and then by experiencing it, actually have some fun doing it, that creates, again, a kind of pool, a wanting desire to do it. Go back to the point, too, though, about the adults. The adults need to play a role, but not an overprotective role. And I was somewhere recently, and a doctor was telling me that kids under 5 years old should not be sedentary when they're not sleeping for more than 60 minutes a day. They should be moving constantly. Now we're having a hard time getting kids moving just 60 minutes a day. And part of it, I do think, is that in all these other societal issues, we're overscheduled, and kids are overscheduled. So that when we go outside, we try to pack too much in it instead of letting them bear experience over non-organized activities, but whatever they want to do. And you know, I read your blog recently about the tipping point for Mike came when his own sons started to organize their own play dates. You didn't have to initiate them, and that's a success. And instead of parents having to do that for kids, kids doing it for themselves. And I think that a big part of this change is going to both come at a meta level from things like getting recess reinstated as part of the reauthorization of the Early Childhood and Secondary Education Act. Absolutely. Has to happen. And then number two, I think it's going to happen by us changing our behaviors, which is probably the harder thing. You know, Dr. Martin Luther King always talked about most people thought racism was wrong, but most people wouldn't change their behaviors about their own sense of racism. And we have to figure out a way to get people to physically change their behaviors. And in the book, you know, I talk about the movement is going from one to many, and it highlights Mike and it highlights Tony Yancey, who's down at UCLA organizing instant recess at corporations, because she realizes that by having 5, 10, and 15 minutes of recess at work, both creates an unstressed environment, number one, but number two, this pent-up demand for play and creativity, because their recess, you know, starts to become much more hierarchical from an anthropological sense, which is a real fun. But I think it's, you know, it's going to take time, and it's going to take practice, and it's going to, you know, take, I think we all got to start doing it, and it's got to start right outside our front doors.
My name is Doug Goodkin, and I'm a music teacher at the San Francisco School where we have recess 2 times a day, and
nice.
Trying to get play back into music education, as in play music and play with music. But I have a difficult question for you. It's clear that your values and your action are completely lined up, but another place where you find a lot of playgrounds is McDonald's. And for a different purpose, it seems, to draw kids in for something that is not necessarily in their best interest. So I'm wondering, in your marriage with corporate world, whether you've had any conflicts of interest where money is offered and you feel, we're not quite lined up with purpose and values.
Sure. I remember when the Ben & Jerry's partnership came out, and when I was talking about that, a lot of people shaking their heads, having smiles in their faces, and the Center for Public Research said, kaboom, building playgrounds shouldn't take money from an organization that makes the worst ice cream for kids and adults. And so the issue becomes, for me, the issue becomes, is from an organizational perspective, is set the guardrails up front so that everybody understands what the process needs to look like, and then manage the process to the point where the organization, the board, and the sponsors who are potentially coming through the pipeline understand what the rules and the guidelines are. Ronald Reagan once said, I would take money from the devil to do God's work. And I'm not sure that the foundations or the governments of the world are going to fund the efforts of Kaboom. I just don't think that they are. But if we can get corporations to both write checks and then come out and volunteer, because that's also where they live and work, I think it's a great marriage, and I'm proud to stand behind that.
Thank you.
This guy's got a question. No? Okay.
Hi, Daryl. Liz Vaughn at Impact. I wanted to ask you a little bit about how Kaboom approaches measurement. So obviously you've got the number of playgrounds a year that you can measure, and then you have all these ripple effects that you talked about. But when you're evaluating impact and progress, how do you deal with those kind of ripple effects in terms of measurement and reporting on your progress?
Very easy, actually, because another Harvard Business School case study done by my almost co-founder over here, Tony Dyflin, first board member, we look at three things: value, leverage, and efficiency. What type of value are we bringing to society? How leveraged is the dollars that you give us? Can we make it go? And then do we get more efficient in being able to run those operations? We have 144 measures that we look at that all feed up from a micro perspective to a macro perspective, where the board is looking at 22 measures. The VPs, you know, are looking at all the measures. And correct me, Jeanetta, if I'm wrong, was it covered on today's staff call? So quarterly, the scorecard gets calculated. We present the meta perspective on an all-staff call, and then teams sit down and look at their metrics. And it's something that has evolved both over time, but is able to help us look at and be honest with ourselves where we're really doing well and where we could actually probably use some more help in codification of that. There is a Harvard Business School case study about it, and you can certainly check it out. It's discipline, though. It's not easy. You have to have a level of consistency around committing to it. I remember when we were actually at Harvard one time presenting the case study, Robert Kaplan, one of the professors who wrote the balanced scorecard, was also in the room. And it was a little bit intimidating. And, you know, at the end of it, he said, there is no right or wrong measures. It's the measures that you stick with over time that you can actually see results on that measures, and it's the process. And what I feel good about is that we've got the process down where it matters now, and it's not just what we're counting, but everything counts for us to understand the impact that we're having and being able to prove it. Free and reduced lunches, things that we look at, where we put our playground projects, you know, how far our dollars go, I mean, a lot of different things. And most of it's automatic tabulated by input. So when somebody's on the phone working with the community organization, they're putting who's on the planning committee. Well, at the end, that spits out a report. You know, the planning committee or the build volunteers existed of 50% corporate and 50% community, or 60% corporate and 40% community. We all measure that automatically by the input as you're going through the process, so that we can look at both ebbs and flows, and it makes it easy for the data to get in there to be analyzed. Mike.
Darryl, I just have a follow-up question that brought to mind. To me, the only thing, the main thing that matters is how many kids' lives are you affecting, and is the impact lasting over a period of time? You said you have a bunch of measures. Do you have a measure like that where you look at a playground 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, and you look at the neighborhood and you see how many kids are actually out there on a regular basis?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we can conservatively say that we've impacted about 5.5 million kids in our 2,000 play spaces that we've built in the 15 years that we've been around. And so the one measure is you can certainly look at this shelter, as an example, serves, you know, 144 kids a year. And they may not be the same 144 kids all year long, because they may actually go into transitional housing or something like that. So as we're inputting that data, we're pulling a real number about how many kids we're actually serving, and then being able to matriculate that over the lifetime of a playground, which is about 15 years. I mean, the other thing is, from a many-to-many perspective, what we want to see is communities start coaching each other. So we have this great example of Imani Wilkes in Philadelphia that organized the playground that now is the alumni coach in Philadelphia, where she's coaching other communities who are both going through our process and independently going through it themselves. So there's a different level of accountability, because there's somebody who's just like them on the ground helping and supporting them out, whereas if Kaboom's going to parachute in, you can make it look good before we get there. If somebody may drop in because they live by there, there's a different level of accountability that kind of happens with that. And with our 2,000 play spaces, what we want to do is create this alumni network to see what radiates and ruminates out of that. Coupled with the fact, that's not the only change that we look at, though. We look at what other factors have changed. Do people volunteer more? Have they gone on to more boards? We did a project with 68 daycare centers down here with the David and Lucille Packard Foundation. And the biggest thing that they saw was that the centers that had unfilled capacity after they built the play space and had parental involvement went above capacity, because when people started to come through the center, they said, wow, this is a vibrant space, and that parents were involved in it, and I want my kids to be there. So for David and Lucille Packard Foundation, it was a tremendous success, because it got these low-income child care centers past capacity, which made them better utilized.
Hello, Darryl.
Hello, Mal. How are you?
Mal Warwick, the One World Football Project. You spoke about the play deficit. And I'm wondering, after hearing some of the numbers that you've been talking about in connection with Kaboom, what is that play deficit? What is the number of playgrounds that you think are lacking in the United States?
Well, I think the deficit's going to exist literally in two dimensions. Time to play, you know, free time, unstructured, recess at school, big component. And I don't want to adjudicate that point. It's not something that, from Kaboom's perspective, that we lead on. We work with organizations like the Alliance for Childhood and PlayWorks and support their efforts to move the needle on this. And we're hard followers on this. And there's a lot of cultural change that needs to happen around more time to play. And then on the spaces side, it's almost to Mike's point. I fear that if we put a number to it, all people are going to try to do is manage to the number. What we want to do, and what I hope that this book does, is allow communities to have conversations about what's good for them. Because what may be good for them in one place may be very different in another place. And if people talk about it, and we have this Playful City USA program where we give communities an accommodation for having these discussions and building a baseline and then improving upon those baselines. And San Francisco has been awarded it 4 times. They're not perfect, but they're certainly working towards the right type of conversation about what makes perfect for them. And we really like that. For us, it's less about saying there needs to be 10 million more parks. There needs to be more parks that are better utilized with more frequency. One thing I will tell you is that when I look at funding, it's true that park and recs and CapEx budgets of cities are generally the first thing to go in bad times. So to some degree, we saw this throttle of spending go almost a decade ago, long before everybody else saw it. And it's generally the last thing that recovers, too. So the spending of our infrastructure of our cities is really in a crumbling sense. If play indeed, though, is the best natural creative resource, right? Sometimes you don't need spaces or places or playgrounds. You just need opportunity, creativity, flexibility. And also, I fear that what's happened because of the lack of funding, we've built destination parks that people got to be driven to. So on Saturdays and Sundays, they're packed. On Monday through Friday, nobody's there. And what we want to see is probably a lot more smaller places that are used more frequently than ones you got to be driven to. Although the ones you got to be driven to are certainly cool, but they shouldn't be the only opportunity of expression that a community is able to have. But we firmly believe that it is not our prescription. It's a description that enables them to have a conversation about it.
The City of New York Department of Parks and Recreation, and to build on your point about dispersed play spaces and actually funding, I know that maintenance was a big issue, and sometimes there was reluctance to build more green streets or pocket parks or community gardens because they weren't sure how they were going to be maintained in perpetuity, and that could be, you know, a burden on the community or the government they're responsible for doing. Can you talk a little bit about how you help support communities to make these continue to be safe, vibrant places to play after they're built?
Well, from Kaboom's perspective, we're really working with child-serving organizations that are not necessarily public entities like schools or parks, partly because we believe schools and parks should be in the facilities building business and actually provide the spaces and take care of the maintenance themselves. What we're doing is complementing child-serving organizations to actually bring them an additional component around outdoor recreation that they may not have at the Boys and Girls Club or a YMCA or something like that. And the way we try to build the ownership into it is having the participation up front and then having the programming that comes afterwards that if a bolt is missing, somebody recognizes it and you can get it fixed quickly instead of waiting for it months to pass by and it becomes a bigger problem than what it is. It is true that in any instance, though, that maintenance is a big issue. And fortunately, I think New York and Commissioner Benepe is doing one of the most amazing jobs in the country. It's saying we are New Yorkers' backyard. And the mayor, our vision statement is a great place to play within walking distance of every child. And the mayor will give us 100% credit, kaboom that is, for his vision statement is a healthy 10-minute walk, a park within a healthy 10-minute walk of every New Yorker. And he certainly recognizes that it's going to take both capital to build and maintenance and programming, but citizens' engagement can help along the way. Commissioner Benepi has also reintroduced risk into design. When we were able to work on Burling Slip, there were a lot of lawyers who advised against it because there were going to be water, and he built 12 spray grounds across New York City, and he's really doing smart things from a policy and politician perspective. That is such courageous leadership that I hope a lot of people follow. And things like when he was sued, the city was sued because a child burned their feet on rubber matting at the playground. He fought it to the end and saying, do we have to put a sign out there to say wear shoes on the playground? And the parent admitted no. Okay, then that's your responsibility. So there is this sense of parental responsibility versus this kind of communal sense of obligation. New York is something to behold, though. Good stuff coming out of there. And they've got four more destination parks that are brilliant, that are going to blow people away.
Hi, Abby Davis in Net Impact. So you talked about your own career path and how finding your purpose and your passion led you to forge a career around play. And I'm curious what advice you might have for people coming out of colleges and graduate school programs trying to chart their own career path. What advice might you give to them?
Yeah, so having just done the Net Impact webinar, I'll say the same thing here I said there, and that was find something that's purposeful and passionate about and then pursue it. And pursue it in any sector that's viable to come up with the solution. What I'm interested in is, and I think what's going to happen, is that we have great means to train great business leaders. We have great means to train public servants. We have great means to train athletes. What I want to see is great means to change agents that use any sector at their disposal to actually solve a problem. And I think it's not going to be true where people spend decades at a singular place anymore or in a singular industry. They may jump around from the nonprofit to the for-profit to the public sector and back and forth, but stay with the same issue like hunger or homelessness or public health or something like that. I do fear, one of my big fears is that this talent gap, that people think that they should go into the nonprofit sector after they've had a successful career somewhere else. And this is the retirement kind of career. And what I'm, and anybody who's in the nonprofit sector knows that's not the case. And, you know, we as nonprofit leaders need to go into the for-profit world and make change from the inside. We need to go into politics and make change there. And people in, you know, the public sector should be coming into our sector instead of just sunsetting here at the end of their career.
Okay, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for only one more. No, we have time for one more question. You still have a chance. But I do want to let our listening audience at home and on the radio know that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight, Saving Kids, One Playground at a Time, with Daryl Hammond, CEO and co-founder of Kaboom and author of Kaboom, the book. And we will have one more question, and then we'll close our program tonight.
Marty with Hello Housing, or an affordable housing developer in the Bay, doing a lot of work related to foreclosure recovery. So I'm curious how Kaboom's strategy has taken into account this new context over the last few years of the foreclosure crisis and how many communities are really struggling with just abandonment and vacancy.
You know, critical mass makes a big difference, and if there's not people living there, it's really hard to build the critical mass. If there are people living there, I think it's a great opportunity to show the spirit of the community and to start to reverse some of the trends of the foreclosure crisis. I'm not sure that I directly know the impact that it's had. I can tell you that it's been harder for our communities to self-organize. It's been harder for them to make the case that play actually matters. And to convince people to give them money to support these. I know that our individual giving has certainly been harder because people are struggling. In many instances, even with our corporate sponsors that we work with, they're downsizing, and that we're working with somebody today, and they're reorganized to something else tomorrow. So it's not just, I think, in the housing and the foreclosure, but there's this true sense of, across the board, not necessarily desperation, but we feel a sense of desperation because of the uncertainty that we continue to face. And we don't think that it's going away anytime soon, at least in our experience right now.
Okay, well, thank you, Daryl Hammond of Kaboom. Our program tonight is Saving America's Children, One Playground at a Time. So with this, I would like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club tonight, our audience listening at home on the Internet and on the radio. And with this, I call this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, to a close.